This question is for Steph. I think one of the roadblocks in trying to explain the concept of anarchy and how it can sort of triumph over the limited government approach is dispute resolution and how you would get compensation if someone broke a contract.
Yep.
And to use an extreme example, like someone murders your son or something, and in your example you'd say this person would be ostracized from the society, they would have a hard time having economic transactions and just having a lifestyle. And I would contrast that approach with Hans Hoppe's, and that you'd say...
With the what?
Hans Hermann Hoppe's approach.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm sure you've read through The Impossibility.
I haven't read a huge amount of Hoppe. I've just read his stuff on national defense, so feel free to expand.
Well, he basically says you have an insurance company, and the insurance company can sort of seek compensation if it's justified. And I think just taking the approach of this individual would be ostracized from this society is kind of difficult for people to grasp because, you know, if someone has a huge bankroll or whatever and they're able to be ostracized and they're okay with that, then what's to stop that person from just breaking your contract or committing acts of violence?
Right.
And I'm wondering why you don't take that approach when discussing, you know, how you would compensate people as opposed to...
That's an excellent question. The status solution to the problem of violence, if this kind of rape, of murder, of assault, the status solution is very, very tempting, of course, because it seems like it's a real solution, right? But, of course, if theft is so bad, then if property rights are absolute, then we can't have taxation because it's a violation of the principle up front. So I would sort of reject that as a solution. It means that we then have to go to more creative places to solve that problem. I'm in no way, shape, or form even remotely intelligent enough to attempt to reproduce the creative intelligence of millions of people to solve this problem. So the solution is going to be infinitely better than anything I come up with as people compete to try and solve this. The first question, if you're thinking about an anarchic solution or a stateless solution to a problem like that, is what would satisfy me, right? So let's say that, I'm going to really ask that question, right? What is it that would, like, if you were looking at someone to protect you from murder or protect those around you from murder, what would you want them to do if, say, your girlfriend or your wife was killed, murdered by some dude, we'll call him Bob, because Bob is our usual guy. If Bob kills your guy, what would you want as your ideal solution to that? Solution is the wrong word. Restitution, or how would it best be handled for you as a potential consumer of someone who would provide services in this area?
Right. Well, my approach would be to try to prevent that from ever happening.
Agreed, absolutely.
And the approach that I think needs to be taken is that the person knows that there's going to be extreme retribution or compensation in that event. So just by taking that approach off the bat, you would kind of avoid that situation. But the situation could still occur. And I don't personally know, just like you said, how many millions or billions of people are going to have better solutions to this. But I would definitely...
No, but sorry, Let's say I'm a GRO, right, and I'm trying to sell you my protection services, right? So I'm doing a show-and-tell, dog-and-pony show. What is it that would be the most appealing to you as the solution to violence committed against you or someone like you? Would you want that person killed? Would you want money from that person? Would you want them to be incarcerated or imprisoned for 30 years and pay you half the money they made at forced labor? And what is it that would be, nobody says this is great, but what would be the most beneficial thing that I could offer you to get your business as a dispute resolution company?
I would want everything back that was taken from me, and if it was impossible.
Yeah, if that's impossible, because we'll talk about murder, right? I mean, what is it that would be, like, cause this is how it would work, yeah, in a free society, is that we would, as a dispute resolution organization, I would be going around saying, how can I make this right for you? What is the best possible solution? So I know it's hard to talk about. Let's just talk about, maybe she gets knocked on the head or something. Like, let's not go with, like...
No, that's fine.
Okay, so you want to go with the murder thing?
Yeah, because you've got to explore the extreme possibilities.
Yeah, let's go with the extremes, absolutely. So your wife gets murdered. What would be the best... it's a weird way to put it, but what would be the best possible outcome of that for you as a potential consumer of protection services?
I would want some kind of monetary retribution.
Right.
But I think it you know, it would be different for everybody. Maybe I don't want the person committing the act of
murder. It is different for everybody, and that's why we need competition, right? It is different for everybody.
Yeah, and me personally, I might want that person to conduct, you know, many hours of community service or something.
Right.
Something nonviolent, something that wouldn't, you know, I just don't want them to go in a jail cell and rot because that's no good for anybody.
Right, and then when they come out, they're crazy, right? I mean, this jail is a terrible solution, right? Even for evil people, jail is a terrible solution, right? Like, jail is a terrible solution for drug addicts, and it's a terrible solution for people to do evil because they just come out and do more evil, right? And the repetition rate for criminals in a status prison system is 80, 90%. It's ridiculous, right? So you want a better solution than that, right? And you certainly want to, the best thing you could do for your wife's memory if she was killed was to, get money to replace the income that would be lost and the support that would be lost and, so your kids could get a good education and you could pay off your house. You'd want that kind of money, right, because it's a significant loss of income to look at it at a coldly calculating economic level. Forget the emotional stuff because it can't be fixed. You'd want money back and you would also want to be damn sure that this wasn't going to happen again.
Right.
Now, a status society is never going to provide you either of those things. You're never going to get money from the criminal, and 80-90% is going to be a recommission of offense.
So my original question is, how come you opt to say this person would be ostracized from society and not be able to conduct commerce instead of saying that...
It's not just that you can't... Then we're going to go to a complete abstract here, and I'll try and keep this short, right? But then there's more about this in Practical Anarchy. But very briefly, you can't rent an apartment. You can't buy food. You can't travel on anyone's property because everything's privately owned. You can't go to a restaurant. You can't even use someone's drinking fountain. You can't participate at all economically in the society. That is what I guarantee you all of the protection agencies are going to work with. So this guy is either going to have to go out and live in the wilderness and gnaw on tree bark and rabbit legs and stuff, which he's not going to do, right? Or he's going to have to submit in order to regain his status as being able to participate in society. He's going to have to submit to some punishment in order to regain his status as an economic actor in society. So he's either going to go out and live in the woods and be nowhere near anyone, in which case you don't get any money, but at least he's not out killing people, or he's going to have to submit to some sort of punishment and hopefully cure for whatever ails him. And so the punishment is going to be you have to work at some job, you get half of his salary, 40% of his salary goes to imprison him and 10% goes to the profit to the DRO or whatever. He's going to go through anger management, he's going to go through psychological counseling, he's going to go through whatever it is to try and get the evil out of his heart so he doesn't do it again. He's never going to be released until people can figure out as best they can, given the inexactness of the science. So it's not just you can't get a job. I mean, you actually can't function in society if people don't want to do business with you. We have computers and the internet, so if you walk into a store and try even to use cash, they're going to be like, murderer, murderer, murderer. And if they give you a meal and you're a murderer, the restaurant will get pulled from the system, right? So it's the best, is this the perfect solution? I don't know, but it certainly is a viable and potential one, and it's a lot better than what the state is going to do for you right now.
Okay, thank you.
Can I respond to that? My name is Don Corleone, and I'm so glad that there is no government. And I'd like to offer another solution to your problem. Right?
That was where I was going to go.
I will personally make sure the family is wiped out. All you have to do is kiss my ring and promise me a favor in the future.
That was right where my question was going to go. If I'm shopping around for DROs, this man just killed my wife. I want his family dead. I want his house. I want his bank accounts. I want him dead. I want him dead. I want him buried upside down on a pike. Now, if you, the DRO, won't do that, I'm going to look for a DRO that will. How does this jive with the non-initiation of force in an anarchistic society?
You actually say you want his family dead? No, really? I mean, that's what you would want? Do you think that would be just?
You're talking to somebody who just had his wife killed.
Sure. No, I understand. I'm just saying, I don't think a DRO is going to be, I'm going to take out the gene pool. right? I'm going to drop a bomb on the city where the guy... No, they're not going to do that, right? They're going to say, yes, that's an extreme response and that's a shame, but we're not going to do that. Sorry.
Or he's going to go after somebody who might do something close to that, you know, or whatever.
Right, okay. But look, let's put things... Yes, you can come up with something. Some crazy guy wants to wipe out the whole family. How does a free society handle that? Well, first of all, by not making him a goddamn president, right? Right, those guys do exist. Maybe you're one of them, right, who want to just nuke the gene pool, right? Okay, but let's not at least give them nuclear weapons, aircraft carriers, and B-52s, right? So there is going to be punishment for the people who do evil, but let's keep the problem in perspective, right? The murder rate in the Wild West when government was very small and remote was absolutely tiny. You could go 5-10 years in a town without a single murder. Some towns went as long as 20 or 30 years without a single murder. Okay, so yes, is there a challenge dealing with the problems of murder in a free society? Absolutely. Will murderers be fewer and far between? Absolutely. Right, because they won't be cops who go nuts. They won't be veterans returning battle-scarred and with PTSD. Right, and there won't be that kind of violence in the home from those kinds of situations which lead to further violence down the road. There won't be prison guards who become dehumanized through beating up and controlling prisoners. There won't be prisoners who are in jail getting beaten up and raped and shivved who are then released back out into the streets, because it will be a different society where we don't use the initiation of force to try and solve these complex, embedded, psychological, difficult problems. So we're talking about, in an average town, you know, a murder or two every 5 years, right? And will society find some way to provide restitution for that? Absolutely. Will everybody want to wipe out the whole gene pool? No, of course not, right? They will be angry in the moment, and the DROs will provide counseling and grief management and try and get them through that difficult time. But the alternative to this as a solution is the state gets an army. The state gets prisons. The state gets to use whatever force it wants at will against anybody, anytime, anyhow, anywhere. Right? So it's important to put these problems in perspective. Right? Do we want maybe 1 out of 10 people having an excessive response to a murder every 5 years, which means we face this problem in one town every 50 years? Or do we want the CIA and the FBI and the U.S. military with 700 bases overseas poking sticks into wasps' nests perpetually, causing the murders of hundreds of thousands of people, right? So again, will anarchy solve everything? Of course not. There's human problems which will be intractable. Some people will go on a rampage and shoot the whole... Absolutely. But given that that potential exists, the last thing we want is a centralized military and police force and prison system.
I'd like to make a little side note here. Essentially, with the DRO, which you mentioned, it wouldn't be as lucrative for them to go around and kill the whole bloody family. If you do that, then, well, then you'd get repercussions from maybe the family's DRO and whatnot. But, on a side note, what I actually want to talk about, the two of you are very concerned with rights. One from an objectivist moral standpoint, the other one from the Constitution. Where do you all think these rights come from?
I don't believe in rights at all.
Good man.
No, right. I don't believe in rights.
All right.
To me, this is, you know what rights are? This is rights.
Please don't hurt me.
That's all it is. It's a request for those in power not to hurt you. That's all a right is. I do believe in objective, universal, absolute morality, and I have a whole crushingly boring book available for free called University Preferable Behavior, which if you ever have trouble sleeping, put it on a low murmur, a little Barry White in the background. The trouble then is waking up, not getting to sleep. But no, I don't believe in rights. I don't believe that they are imbued within us. You know, they don't believe that there are weak atomic forces that cling rights within Earth. You know, I think that they are... human beings have properties. We don't have rights. We have properties like we are ambulatory for the most part. We breathe oxygen. We're carbon-based. We are the rational animals sometimes. Right? So we have properties, and those properties biologically are universal, which is how we're classified as Homo sapiens, so we don't get ourselves confused with sea anemones. We have properties which are universal, and I think those should be respected as biological and physical facts, but we do not have rights. No government can take away the fact that I have mass. No government can take away the fact that I have scalp. No government can take away the fact that I breathe oxygen and I'm carbon-based. Right? So those are just facts and properties about human beings. But since governments can take away rights, the rights are just purely illusory. And of course, begging people to leave you alone never works. Because they're like, oh, you want freedom? Great. Then I'll start taking it away so that you'll give me stuff because that's what you really want. It's like saying to a torturer, you know, it really hurts when you do this. Well, what does the torturer want to do? Bam, bam, bam. So I don't believe in rights. I think that you have a different approach, and certainly the objectivists do, but I don't believe that they exist any more than fairies do.
A difference. We've discovered a difference. When Stefan was down on his knees begging, he wasn't begging for rights, he was begging for privileges. You know, rights... You know. Rights are not please don't hurt me. Rights are you will not hurt me. Thomas Jefferson said, you only have the rights that you are willing to, you know, fight for. I have freedom of speech, not because they wrote the and ratified the First Amendment back in 1791. I have freedom of speech because I've never met anybody big enough to shut me up. So we spoke at the Independence Mall yesterday, and, I mean, of all the places in the United States, Independence Hall, 4th of July, I mean, it was... This was the best 4th of July, the best Independence Day I've ever had, you know, to be looking at Independence Hall. And then I discovered, thank you, that I discovered that as I'm speaking on this little podium, there's this little concrete square, which was a free speech zone. We're celebrating independence, and the government is going to allow me my opinion on this concrete pad? Are you kidding? Anywhere I happen to be standing is a free speech zone. The government doesn't tell me what I can or cannot say. The government doesn't tell me where I can or cannot say it. So rights do exist. You cannot take somebody's rights away. You know, you can take their life, but you can't take their right to life. And, you know, if rights don't exist, then I'm not sure exactly what the philosophical discussion is about. What is it that we're trying to protect? You know, life, liberty, and private property. That's the whole point of having written the Constitution at all. Imagine a hypothetical conversation between Thomas Jefferson and Patrick Henry. The sky is shining, the sun is shining, the birds are flying, and, you know, butterflies, the crops are growing, the children are laughing and giggling. I mean, it is pretty much heaven on earth. Can you imagine a conversation that said, you know, what we need is a government that's going to oppress us, raise our taxes. I mean, everything's like too perfect. If we, you know, just get bored. If we at least had a government trying to oppress us, then we'd have a reason to wake up in the morning. It would keep us, you know, like, I can't even imagine that as a concept. More to my reality is that, you know, life is nearly perfect, almost heaven on earth. And they said, you know what we need? We need a system to protect it just the way it is so that we can maintain this type of perfection, this type of heaven on earth, to secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves and our posterity. It's a goal. It's a laudable goal. We may never achieve it. We certainly have, you know, gotten further from it today than we used to be, but we really do. We need to continue working on it. It's a constant process. You know, philosophy, you're constantly, every day, learning more philosophy, honing it, making it, you know, better, eliminating any contradictions that you have. I think the same thing is true with government. It's never going to be perfect. It may be okay today, but we have to keep monitoring it and constantly making it better and not letting it, you know, grow without supervision.
Gentlemen, thank you, and and Stefan and Michael, a great presentation today. Stefan, I want to direct a couple comments towards you and then ask you a quick question if I could. First, one of your statements, I'll use a scare tactic to say that we do not have the ability to fight our governments, our large arsenal of bombs, weapons, and super-duper throwdown weapons to stop us. But at the same time, you said, well, we can't even stop the insurgents overseas. And I find it pretty fascinating that a bunch of people that live, if you will, in clay houses can't stop the most tyrannical governments in the world. So certainly we as a people have the ability to go ahead and change our destiny no matter how big our military force in this government is. And secondly, the second comment I want to bring up was an anarchy society that does not have a tax base is not one that is going to be desirable from a tyrant's point of view. And I will argue that point by saying that if I were a tyrant looking to take over a disorganized society that did not have a tax base, that would be a no-brainer because I would march right in there, take over their rights, promptly tax them, whether you have a current tax base or not, and then promptly throw them into servitude. So whether they have a tax base or not does not make them undesirable for a tyrant. Now, I will ask you one more thing on the DRO, and that is anytime you give someone more responsibility or more power than the people have, they themselves will become tyrannical, just like government does. So the question I have for you is you've given these people to be judge, jury, and hangman at the same time, how do you keep their powers to a minimum without so they don't overstep your boundaries? And that's the bottom line. You pretty much instituted government at that point.
Yeah, I'm not saying I've convinced you. I'm not saying I've closed the case. I'm just saying there's a possibility that it may not be as bad as you think, as far as I can get. I want to be respectful to other people's questions.
Thank you very much. Back to government.
Ah, thank you.
The wonderful topic of the day. One thing I haven't seen come up yet, and thank you everybody who's here because it's great for people to have an open mind, no matter what philosophy, we won't know what we know until we hear it. So it's good to hear all different sides, whether we agree with it or not, to find out whether or not we do agree with it, because hearsay, you don't know what you're getting. I heard I needed a garlic or something to come near you because you were a vampire. You're going to bite. You don't really bite.
No, I don't even chew.
All right. One thing I haven't heard come up yet is something to do with the world. The world isn't going to follow our anarchist form of non-government. What would happen if, I don't know, South Korea decides they're going to nuke Hawaii, and we don't, if I'm understanding it right, we have no government. We have nobody in power. We have nobody to make decisions for our landmass. How does that work? Because we're not going to lay down and roll over and take it.
That's
assuming,
a great question.
Correct?
I guess the first question I would have is, why does South Korea want to nuke Hawaii now? Or why are they threatening to do so? Why are they threatening to nuke Hawaii and not Switzerland? No, it's not because they're actually, I think, well, why are they threatening to nuke Hawaii rather than China or some other country that's local to the Far East where they could actually get their rockets? The reason that they're threatening, the reason that Al-Qaeda, the reason that these other countries threaten the United States is, and I'm certainly not defending the retaliatory use of force in these situations, which is going to be almost certainly against defenseless civilians, but the reason is that the American government is using and deploying massive amounts of force overseas, right? That they are, they have black ops, they have, you know, these 700-plus military bases overseas, they have funded governments, the U.S. government is the largest arms seller in the world. It's like having a police protection agency that is actively taking your money to arm criminals that they claim to be defending you against. And so because the United States is taking your tax money, the government, and going and doing all these terrible things overseas, funding dictatorships, arming dictatorships, funding oppressors, overthrowing governments, invading, conquering, undermining societies around the world, there is a hatred of America, and they can't strike at the American government. They strike in the American people, which I don't agree with, of course, but the reason that we don't need a government to protect us from North Korea is only threatening us because of our government, and I use the word R to be Canadian, but you know what I mean, right? It's the solution to statism is not more statism. The problems caused by statism should not be why we rely on statism, right? We should really try and stop the problems at the core. You know, and say, oh, Al-Qaeda hates us because we were free. Well, Americans were a hell of a lot more free 100 years ago, and Al-Qaeda and the Muslims didn't touch us at all.
Okay, but what if it happened?
But it's not going to happen if you don't have a government.
No one's ever going to aggress against us, ever. What if it happens?
What do you mean,
could
what if
it happens?
Happen?
No, it's not going to happen because no country has ever...
We have a forced field around us now because we're anarchists.
No, because, as I said earlier, you have the two-part solution. One is that no one's going to want to just nuke you for the hell of it because you have nukes and can nuke them back, right? So it's mutually assured destruction.
Who's in charge of the nukes, though, on our part, to nuke them back?
Well, you would have defense agencies who would compete among people to provide the cheapest and most effective deterrence to invasion, but you would not have, as you currently have, massive forced fiat currency funding of aggression overseas. Because if nobody would want it, I mean, people are for the Iraq war, but it's like, well, you take the bill, right? Don't send me the bill if I'm against it. So people would not be funding aggression overseas. They would be funding the cheapest and most effective form of deterrence to avoid an invasion, and that could take many, many different forms. But I don't believe that some madman would just suddenly up and want to come and nuke people. That just doesn't happen in history. There are very specific circumstances to lead to that kind of anger and aggression towards the U.S. government.
This question is for both Stefan and Michael. You both expressed approval of privatization of roads and other currently public or what I consider to be the commons, common territories. What would the effects be on the individual rights, or as Stefan asserts, privileges? Let's look at a road, for example. If a road were privatized, could there not be constrictions on the individual to say that you must have a license, you must have two headlights present on your car, you must have a good moral account in your local town? I mean, all of these different precautions, so to speak, or liens could be put on the individual. How do we address that, in the fact that, I mean, take it one step further, when entire towns are privatized, in order to live there, you would have to relinquish your right to free speech or your right to religion. These are real contradictions to a free society in which you have to deal with privatization. I would like to hear both the speaker's responses.
Does everybody realize that Saddam Hussein started out as president of a homeowners association and kind of like worked his way up to tyrant? I don't deny that, you know, society needs rules. I mean, we are a social people. We all have, you know, different opinions, different values, different ethics. And, you know, we need to figure out a methodology of coexisting in the same relatively, you know, small space without killing each other. You know, that's, and in the study of any philosophy, that would be the political level. You know, you have your personal ethics, and you exist in a society with other people whose ethics are different from yours, and again, we need to coexist. So there need to be certain accepted rules. There's no right reason that the government has to establish those rules. You know, speed limit. Most people don't follow the speed limit. You know, everybody kind of... I think the general rule is, what, 10 miles an hour over? You can probably do that for a long time without getting a speeding ticket. But, you know, there's another traffic rule that says, you know, you don't drive on the left side of the yellow line. You know, and I don't know many people that violate that rule. Not because there's a squad car around every corner, because if you drive on the left side of the yellow line, you're probably going to end your life here real soon. So, again, there's not always going to be an easy answer. The answer is always property. But, you know, when you get to water and air, okay, we've agreed that I own this piece of land and it has a stream going through my land. Okay, what water do I own? Okay, this is my water. Oops, it's moving. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, gosh. Okay, so now I own Stefan's water. Okay, it is moving. So... You know, it's a difficult process, but just because it's difficult doesn't mean that we don't need to come up with the answer. As far as private roads, most roads were private. You know, I have some store or facility, I want customers to get there, I build the road to make it easier for you to, you know, get to my store. The government, under the Constitution, is allowed to, you know, build post offices and post roads. The reason for the roads was to get the mail from one spot to another. Everything else was, you know, kind of like, you know, make a trail.
There are all sorts of historical examples of private investments, you know, working. The Erie Canal was supposed to connect, you know, like New York City with the rest of the country west of the Appalachians. And so they privatized it completely, you know, private investments. They dug this canal, I don't know how much, is 100 miles or something like that. And it was making a profit for the investors before it even opened. So, you know, we need to have some organization. We need to have some rules. It doesn't have to be government. And people say, well, yeah, that's true, but, you know, we have to have government in control of the police. No, you don't. Well, yeah, how would you do it? How about Beverly Hills? You pay to have your own security guards. You know, I'm sure that the Beverly Hills police, you know, drive around in their cars, but if you've got enough money, you know, you pay to have your own security guard, my own personal police officer sitting there at the front gate, you know, to check people coming in and out of my property. So, you know, if you're poor, you can't afford a security guard at the front gate, so you go out and buy a Saturday night special. What's a Saturday night special? Well, it was any gun that you could afford. You know, people who live in the ghetto are the ones most likely to need self-defense. And so the government basically says, well, okay, you can have any gun you want except one that you can afford. A Saturday night special is just some arbitrary label, you know, on inexpensive pistols that make it socially unacceptable for, you know, poor people to defend themselves. So, you know, there are a lot of different solutions. And again, you know, it's your life. You have the responsibility of feeding yourself and protecting yourself. And we need to come up with other solutions other than big government.
I have a sort of unique experience to bring to bear in these kinds of political questions. I mean, I've had a pretty varied career in being an entrepreneur. And when you're an entrepreneur and you want to create a business, and almost all businesses need investment, you go to investors and you have to, oh, it's crazy, you have to prepare so much stuff and you have to do your market research and you have to talk to potential customers and figure out exactly what they want. You have to research the competition and you have to create all these really boring charts about where you land on the XY of various competition features. Yes, we're more expensive, but people really want these features and here's the demographic we're going to appeal to and this, and that's how you get investors. And investors will see, right, let's say that you're going to create roads, right? Investors will be specialized in investing in road companies. And let's say that we need to build a road from this podium to this podium. The investment community will literally have a dozen companies come through saying, give us $100 million to build this road. And the investors will ask, oh, it's horrible. It really is. It's like swinging light bulbs and truncheons when they ask you every single conceivable question under the sun to figure out if you've really done your homework and your research to please your customers better than everyone else who's presenting to them that day, that week, that month, that year. It's a really grueling process. This is exactly how it would work in a free society. Every rule that you apply to a road has overhead that someone has to pay for. So if you say you got to have both your headlights on, then you have to verify that. You have to have people checking it out. You have to have punishments. You have to block people from coming onto your road or give them some DRO. There's going to be overhead to it. And so when you go to the investors and you say, I want two lights on every car, they're going to say, how much is that going to cost? Right? And you're going to say, well, it's going to cost me an extra $200,000 a year. Well, why would people pay that, they're going to say? Well, because it cuts accidents by 20%. And we've done the market research. We've talked to 500 or 1,000 potential clients, and they've all said, I will pay $5 more a month happily to get a 20% reduction in my possibilities of accidents. Right? That's how things work in a free society. Right? It's hard for us to remember that. I mean, most of it, unless you've been in that situation, you wouldn't really know much about it. I'm sorry, that sounds annoyingly condescending, and I really do apologize, but it was a shock to me when I first went through that whole process a couple of times. So every time you want to impose a rule on whatever it is you're building in a free society, everything from collective defense to roads to healthcare, you have to prove to incredibly annoying, hard-bitten, skeptical investors why your solution is something that customers will want more than every other thing that they could conceivably invest in that year. So you have to do such a staggering amount of homework. You have to build your case. You have to have done all the research. And so when the road finally comes into existence, the rules are never arbitrary. They're designed to be as effective as humanly possible based on the greatest value it will provide to consumers that you have verified by actually asking them. Right? So that's a long answer, but it's really, really important. Things don't just pop into existence in a free society. They go through an incredibly grueling process of ensuring that the maximum value at the cheapest price is created for every single consumer. It will be the case with defense bureaus. It will be the case with healthcare, insurance, property protection. Everyone has to go through this annoying, horrible, you know, it's like it makes a frat initiation look like a tea party. What you have to go through to try and get people to invest in you in a free market. So they, I guarantee you, through that process, which you never get from the government, you get quite the opposite, through that process, you will end up with the roads and the hospitals and the schools and everything will be incredibly tuned and retuned and retuned to meet exactly what gives people the most value at the cheapest price. And that is the inevitable process of trying to get funding and trying to get find customers in a truly free and competitive market. And it's so hard for us to understand when we look at government monopolies what is possible in terms of tuning yourself to your market. But there will be the exact right amount of rules. And if people stop wanting two lights, then you'll go to one light and you'll drop their rates by $5 a month because that's what they've expressed preference for. Does that make any sense at all? Well, sorry, legal and moral code, I mean, we were talking about roads, right? So the legal and moral code is a whole other issue, and maybe we can talk about that afterwards because I want to make sure we get to other questions if that's all right. But I was really just talking about two lights on a highway kind of thing. Another question? I don't have the mics. Who's got the mic? Oh, Mike. Oh, yes, you had a question for a while.
Thank you. My question is actually for you, Mr. Badnarik. Earlier you mentioned that the reason that we needed government to protect people in issues of like disputes is because nobody wanted to initiate, force themselves. People cringe at the idea of initiating violence. And I wonder if you would disagree that part of that is actually a symptom of the collectivist society we have. Like, there's been social experiments to show that when someone collapses on a subway, if there's a bunch of people, nobody helps. If there's one person, you feel like it's more dependent on you, you're more likely to help. So do you think that's possible, that the reason people don't want to take on the, like you said, you'd be willing to, you know, arm yourself and defend your property, but most people wouldn't? Do you think that's more of a symptom of the fact that we've been ideologically or socially conditioned to believe that that's not our responsibility, that's the government or the police force?
I do think that the collectivist tendency in the world is because people don't want the responsibility themselves. You know, we want, and I think it stems fundamentally from our origins in family. When you're, you know, 5 years old, you don't make your own decisions. Mom and dad make those decisions for you. They feed you, they shelter you, and, you know, and life is really good because you're protected and you have no responsibilities. You know, the epitome of that is when you get to college. You know, gosh, life is really good. You get to make your own decisions. You get to decide when you go to bed at night. You get to decide what you watch on TV, how much alcohol you drink. Oh, wow, this is really great. But, you know, car insurance is due, and you go, Dad, and I need a check for car insurance. I need a check for my tuition. So, you know, college is utopia because you have all the benefits and none of the responsibilities, you know. And so I think that having done that, we, you know, mom and dad finally go, thanks, you're out of college, our responsibility is done, you know, get your own apartment, you know. And, you know, we go, wow, life used to be a whole lot better when I had somebody taking care of me. And I think we have a tendency to want government to do that. I don't know if it is true, but I've always believed that Winston Churchill, I've always heard the quote attributed to him. If it's not him, I apologize. But the quote is that if you are 20 years old and you are not a socialist, you have no heart. And if you are 40 years old and you are still a socialist, you have no brain. And, you know, the back on that is that, you know, socialism has such great marketing. It's like everybody's going to have everything. You're going to have food. You're going to have shelter. You're going to have education. You're going to have health care. Life is going to be wonderful. You know, it's just kind of like, you know, that the marketing is great. Who wouldn't want that? It's like, yeah, I mean, that sounds like heaven on earth. I want that. But then you realize that, oh, wait a minute, you've got a job, and all of a sudden the government is taking taxes out of your paycheck that you work so hard for, and you know you can't buy the stuff that you wanted because taxes are so high because you're paying for other people's health care, other people's education, other people's stuff. And you go, oh, wow, I mean, that. You know, you reach maturity and you go, wow, this pretty much sucks. It's a redistribution of wealth. And so, you know, the socialism is really wonderful, but the problem is that you eventually run out of other people's money.
So, Mr. Baderach?
Yes.
I appreciate you trying to inject liberty into a political process that seems to be against liberty. You mentioned eternal vigilance several times to protect that liberty. The only option I see is to spend my life trying to convince 150 million plus one to my way of thinking. That level of eternal vigilance isn't free. It sounds like being enslaved to freedom. So you did say I am free. If I'm free to do what I want with my property, I should be able to look through a brochure and decide what government serves my needs the best and who gets access to my property. I know that it is panarchy, but I do not want to spend my life creating or chasing after different government packages. Millions of people with good ideas routinely succeed selling their products and services in the free market. You spoke of minarchism as a possible path to anarchy. I ask whether your ideal government would allow and work with competing institutions for what you define government functions to be.
Well, I mean, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. I mean, I don't like it any more than you do. I mean, we're supposed to be able to pursue life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And, you know, I mean, I'm happy to do it, but that's not my pursuit of happiness. I'm a skydiving instructor. You know, I want to jump out of perfectly good airplanes, you know, drink beer and chase attractive women. That's the way I pursue happiness, you know, and I can't do that, you know, because my government is taking, when I lived in California, my federal, state, and FICA taxes totaled 48%. And I don't know where you guys went to school, but when I was growing up, that was half. And there is absolutely no way I am going to give half of my productive output to the government. No way. You're going to have to come and take it. So because, you know, previous generations have allowed the government to get this far out of control, I mean, it's not my fault. I didn't allow, you know, the New Deal. I didn't, you know, encourage Vietnam. You know, it's like I just looked around and it's like, oh, this is the hand I've been dealt. This is the government that is here. And I can sit and, you know, complain about it a lot, but that's not going to solve the problem. So I'm destined to travel across the country teaching people the difference between rights and privileges and, you know, hopefully with my 8-hour class, motivate people. And you suggested that I have to, you know, convince 150 million plus one people to my way of thinking. Yes, that's what I mean when we say that this is an ideological war. This is a war of ideas, and I am promoting the idea of individual rights and private property. And the sooner 300 million people in the United States adopt that idea, the sooner I can, you know, like, pack my suitcase and go back to the airport and jump out of perfectly good airplanes. And right now, I am vastly, vastly outnumbered. Most of the people in the United States are socialists. They don't know it. But they like the government handout.
Well, you know, assuming you could get that 150 million one, and in your ideal minarchist society, would you allow free competition against government services?
Yes, absolutely. And we've already got demonstration of that. The post office, I mean, and most of you aren't even old enough to know the post offices that I went to. It's kind of like the witch's house in Hansel and Gretel. I mean, they were dark and dirty and, you know, kind of like a scary place to go. Mom would say, you know, Michael, I'd like you to go buy some stamps. It's like, no, please. You know, now post offices are pretty clean. They're fairly modern. They've got the, you know, new blue logos. It didn't always used to be like that. The post office had to literally clean up its act when Federal Express started being, you know, if you absolutely positively have to get it there overnight, use Federal Express. And people did. It was expensive, but it worked. True story, went into a post office, and there must have been 40 people waiting ahead of me. You know, and you got to take that little number like you're at the meat counter, you know, and I sit down and they actually have park benches in the post office because they know you're going to be there. I mean, you may as well take a book. And, well, you know, when I get frustrated, I also get a little bit devilish and devious. And so I was sitting on a bench next to some guy and we were just sitting there and I kind of looked at my little slip and I said, mine says Tuesday. What does yours say? And he looked at his slip. He thought he was going to have to come back tomorrow. You know, and the sad thing is the post office is the most efficient federal agency we have.
Well, would the post office be a function of your ideal minarchist government?
The post office is one of the things specifically listed in the Constitution. That doesn't mean we can't get rid of it. You know, you want to come up with a privatized solution? Hey, I'm all in favor of it. I mean, newspapers are going away. I mean, most of your newspapers are having trouble just, you know, staying funded because, like, who wants to, you know, pay for all that chopped up tree? Most of us, many, many more of us are now getting our information, you know, from the Internet. You know, we've got, I thought I saw an iBook here, you know, where it's, everything is electronic. We're going away from paper. You know, and the people who are newspaper editors, you know, may feel a little bit threatened by that. But I'm sure that the people who operated the livery stable for years and years, you know, for generations, felt a little bit threatened when, you know, Henry Ford came up with this, you know, like motorized little buggy. You know, progress happens. Deal with it.
Yeah. Now I have the mic up here. This question is for both. I've really enjoyed the back and forth of this, how much government is necessary, but I don't think we've ever really defined what government is. I mean, in
government is that which is unnecessary. Sorry.
In response to Karen's question about Korea or any country nuking us, you said that the defense agency would be responsible for any retaliation. If that's not government, what is it?
The government technically, and I think that we would agree on this, that the government is the conceptual label for a group of individuals for whatever time period who have the legal right to initiate the use of force within a given geographical area.
Okay, can I stop you there? And just ask...
You certainly can. It's your question.
Okay. If I, as an individual, have the right to use force in defense of myself, when does it become a government? Okay, because I can use force to defend myself. If I group with one other person, we're walking down the street, and we see five people with their weapons drawn coming towards us, obviously we both, together, have the right to use force in order to protect ourselves.
Absolutely. I think so, I see where you're going with this.
So when does it become government? How many people
there's two functional characteristics of government, right? The first is that it initiates the use of force. And it does that for two reasons. To prevent competition and to take money. I mean, there's other things like regulations and so on. But the fundamental thing is that you can't set up a competing police agency in the current system. You can set up a competing post office if they let you, though I think that you still can't charge less than the post office, which is heavily subsidized. you don't have the right to initiate the use of force as an individual or as any number of groups. You have the right of self-defense, which is universal.
Well, you're just answering the question under our basic current system. Okay, you're not answering it in a more general sense.
Okay, well, sorry, what am I not answering? I must have missed it. I apologize.
How many people acting together does it require to become defined as government?
None.
Okay,
so anybody who claims the right to initiate force is wrong and a criminal if they act upon that premise. No matter how many people get together, they can call themselves a government. It is just the mafia by another name. Because that which is moral or immoral for the individual does not change depending on how many people get together, which I'm sure we all agree on.
So it
never becomes valid. Now, the mafia that wins will call itself the government, will indoctrinate the children to worship it, will bribe all the people in the world with all the productive people's money to gain allegiance, will start wars, will do all of these terrible things, and they'll call themselves the government. But that just means best mafia. Mafia that won.
I would agree with that, okay? But still, we haven't defined what government is as far as...
No, we have.
Huh?
We have. The legal right to initiate use of force in a given geographical area.
Okay, well, I have the right to initiate force if I feel that if somebody has a gun pointed to my head.
Yes, I mean, they initiate force to prevent competition and to take money, right? That's the definition of it. And they obviously claim the legal and moral right to have all pomp and circumstance because you can't, I mean, they have to put the gun in velvet, right? Because you see the gun and you're like, oh, I'm a slave, right? And so they have to put all this nonsense and drape the flag and parades and blah, 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 right? Because nobody wants to see this, right? Because that makes you feel humiliated and you might want to change. But there's no group of people who will inevitably gain that moral right, but if there is a group that claims and acts upon that moral right to initiate force, usually within a geographical area.
Well, and I said at the very beginning in my opening thing, we need to define, you know, establish definitions, and those definitions may change as we go along. You know, my question was, does mutual cooperation, you know, constitute government? In your hypothetical, as I understood it, you know, you're walking along all by yourself with a gun for self-defense. And I think your question was, how many of you standing shoulder to shoulder in a row constitute government? Well, if you're all there independently with your own gun for self-defense, I mean, I don't think that it does constitute government. My premise earlier is that it's a hypothetical. You know, and I would certainly be happy to carry a gun to defend myself, but most people won't. And so you get a lot of people who say, you know, I don't want to carry a gun. I'm afraid of guns. I don't know how to use guns. I want someone else to do my protection for me. And so we're going to hire the security guard to stand out at the front gate to presumably shoot the bad guys. You know, the question is how big of a security force do you have to have? And I agree with Stefan. The initiation of force is never legitimate. I mean, George Washington said that government is not reason. Government is not eloquence. It is force. And like fire, it is a dangerous servant and a fearful master. We create this government to protect us, but we've got to kind of watch it so that it doesn't, you know, outgrow, you know, the original purposes. You know, the government that is supposed to protect you can grow big enough to threaten you and become, you know, a greater threat than, you know, the problems that you were worried about originally. So, I mean, I'm curious as to what your definition of government is. If Stefan and I, you know, get a voluntary cooperation, I'll help him protect his property. He helps me protect my property. Do we actually have to write something on paper for it to be a government? You know, if we create a one-page, you know, contract, and we go, okay, this looks pretty good, and, you know, if I see anybody taking your stuff, I'll shoot him, and we both sign the contract. Does that constitute government? I mean, I don't know what, I mean, and we would have, I don't know how many people we have in the audience, but I'm sure we can come up with, you know, probably a dozen or more different definitions of what constitutes government.
Okay, well, I guess my question is, what would this say? Well, it would be called a company, right? It would be a. It would be a company. It would be a company with a tank. It does not have the right to initiate force, to extract money from a disarmed population, and it doesn't have the ability to initiate force to prevent competition. But the government, by definition... Yeah, of course it doesn't actually have, if we use the word rights colloquially, it doesn't have that right, but it exercises that right, let's say. Right, whereas the DRO agency would not, because free market, voluntarism, and you would obviously... I mean, the DRO would say, look, if I ever have one bullet more than I'm supposed to, I'll pay every one of my subscribers $10,000, and there'll be an independent audit, and all the safeguards and checks and balances which never work with government really do work in the free market. So. I'm sorry, let's continue this if you want after, but let's make sure we get the other questions in, because... no, not you, Jim. Anyone else? No, just kidding. Go on. He has tough questions. Anyone else?
First, thank you both for coming. I've really enjoyed this discussion today. My question is for Michael, and I know we're sort of struggling with the definition of government, and I think a lot of what we're quote-unquote disagreeing about here, it may be a matter of semantics. What I wanted to ask you, Michael, is if you're saying we need to have a government, a minimal government, what are those minimum government functions that are essential to have a government for that could not be provided better under a free market system? And I'm not talking about a collective defense, because that's not a government. I think when we say government, we are talking about initiation of force. So in that context, what would these essential government services be?
Well, the purpose of the Constitution and the government we're supposed to have is to protect our life, liberty, and property. That's the goal. How we go about it is basically a procedure, and, if this procedure's not working, when any form of government becomes destructive of your rights, we can establish a new one. And again, I mean, I like the individual responsibility thing. I mean, I don't want to have to pay for your education, and I don't need you to do my defense. I'm perfectly happy doing it all by myself, but most people aren't. And so the things that are basically necessary are to provide services for the people who don't want to provide them themselves. I mean, I have a right to communicate with you, but Philadelphia is a little bit long distance from Dallas, and I don't want to have to get in the car and travel 27 hours every time I want to hand you an envelope. So there is a system available where I can, scribble an address on the envelope, drop it into a box, and somebody else will pick it up and, do the traveling for me. I like that. It saves me a lot of time having to come back and forth. I mean, I love Philadelphia, and I come back frequently, but it would just be inefficient in my life. And so it's partially division of labor. All of us have a higher standard of living if you don't have to do everything for yourself. You get really, really good at one thing, and then you pay for other people's services who are really better at those things than you are. There are certain things that we don't want to do, and I give, self-defense as one of them. I mean, there are probably others. So, if we had people who were smart enough and responsible enough to want to do everything for themselves and just do everything on a, voluntary interactive basis, it'd be like, wow, this is wonderful. But people are not that smart, people are not that ethical, and people are not that responsible. So that's the direction I want to move. So at this point in time, the founding fathers did their best to say, well, okay, most of the government is going to be at the local level, so that you can go down to the, city hall and, like smack your representative upside the head. The state government is going to handle, most of the things. Murder is a state issue. It's not a federal issue. And the federal government is supposed to be really, really small, to handle the things that's just not practical, you know, for each state to get into. It's economy of scale. We're going to have one army, you know, that will defend all 50 states. We can have a really good army, and, you know, that way we don't have to have, you know, competition. Most of you are probably not old enough to remember AT&T was the only company, and it gave really great service. And then the government tried to help us and broke them down into smaller baby Bell companies. And, you know, it's like it took a long while before but we still have people going, well, you know, Verizon and AT&T and all these different, companies, you know, it is the free market. Some people have better service than others. Depends on what area you live in. But, it may not have all the advantages that, you know, like one phone system that worked might have had. So, I mean, I really don't care. Society will figure out those things. And, you know, as soon as everybody grows up and is responsible enough to do their own thing, yeah, then we can probably get rid of government.
I don't have anything to add.
Do you guys have any tired arms? You might have a better view than I do.
Oh, yeah, that's the gentleman and the lady in red. No, the guy here, right, sorry.
Red?
Yeah.
Just a follow-up to that response for Michael. You mentioned that we wouldn't be very productive as people if we all had to do everything that we needed ourselves. And you mentioned the division of labor. My question is, how come we can't just let other people fulfill our need for self-defense in a open market? Why? It sounded like, to answer his question, you wanted to give the government a monopoly on self-defense.
I don't believe that's what I said. If that's what it sounded like, I certainly didn't intend that. I'm happy to do, defense on the open market, and I gave an example of Beverly Hills is where people do that. It's an open market. You've got the police. You've got the public Hollywood police department out there with their black and white cars. And, well, you know, for rich people, that's not good enough, and so they hire private security. If you're really rich, you can hire a bodyguard that will follow you around and, you know, presumably beat up anybody that tries to hurt you. I don't need a bodyguard, don't want a bodyguard. You know, I would really like, one of my issues is the Second Amendment, and I would like to be able to carry a gun. I mean, for the most part, nobody messes with me anyway, just because of the attitude that I carry. But, my attitude would sure like to be backed up by, you know, a .45 underneath my shoulder. I'd be happy to do that. And you know, people are really, really polite. There's a saying that an armed society is a polite society. And if you've never gone to a gun show, I mean, you know, everybody at the gun show, I mean, you're walking down the tables and you're looking at the different things and you bump into somebody and it's immediately, oh, excuse me, sorry, just trying to walk around. And everybody's like, you know, they don't want you to think that I was like trying to violate your space or anything. And in my personal experience, the people that I really like, the people that I'd like to have around closest to me, not always, but usually, turn out to be gun owners. It's like they are the people who are, you know, calm and confident. They have nothing to prove, you know. And on the other end of that spectrum, I have a personal friend, really good friend. I love this guy. And we coexist as friends because we've got a mutual agreement not to talk about politics. You know, we that's the one issue that we don't talk about. Because, I mean, I can't, my arm doesn't reach far enough to the left. So my car was in the shop. He picked me up for work about 4 days in a row. And during those 4 days, it's like, you know, I think twice, three times he came, you know, picked me up. And he's just seething in the morning. You know, it's like, you know, good morning. He goes, man, I almost called you last night. Really? What for? He goes, I was so pissed I wanted to come and borrow your gun and blow some son of a bitch away. And I go, oh, no wonder you're afraid of everybody having a gun, because you think everybody thinks the way you do. You know, if you think that you want to go out and blow people away, you assume everybody else, yeah, it would be pretty much a bloodshed alley. Most gun owners are not like that. You know, I am not a violent guy. I'd much rather give you a hug. You know, just, you know, don't try to hurt me. And I want to put a real good guarantee on that by, you know, carrying my shoulder holster.
I have a question for Mr. Bednarik. You know, we've talked about the Constitution, and I guess the original intent was to have an indirect tax to fund the government's operations. Could you talk a little bit about how the government would fund its operations, what you foresee going in the future of how this would work? And B, would you be able to, as a citizen, opt out of funding a government?
This was like one of the most common questions I heard when I was running for president of the United States. You know, it's like my statement as a libertarian was that we're not going to lower taxes, we're going to eliminate the IRS. You know, and when people like recover from the shock and, you know, like catch their breath, they go, well, how are we going to pay for all this government if we get rid of the IRS? And it's a trick question. It presumes an answer. You know, if I ask you, do you still beat your wife? The question presumes that, you know, either you did beat her and you've stopped, or you are continuing to beat her, but either way, at one point in the past, you did beat her. Well, if you ask me that question, I'm sorry, I can't answer the question because I've never been married. So when you ask the question, how are we going to pay for this government, it presumes that this government is legitimate and should be paid for. The real question is, what is it that we should be paying for in the first place? We signed the Declaration of Independence in 1776. The IRS and income taxes didn't happen until 1913. So by my arithmetic, that was well over 100 years where we had no income tax, no IRS, and the United States government had more money than it knew what to do with. How did that happen? Well, at least for the beginning part of our country, government was limited by Article 1, Section 8, and Congress wasn't doing anything outside of that list. And so because the federal government was really small, there really wasn't a whole lot to pay for. And so the Founding Fathers paid for that very limited government using excises. And it wasn't like, well, we like your country, so you're only going to get a 5% excise. But, you know, this country over here doesn't play ball with us, so we're going to raise it to, you know, like a 50% import tax. You know, it was just kind of, I don't know what the percentage was, but just hypothetically, 5% for any country or foreign company that wanted to sell here. You know, you're not collecting a lot of money, but you also don't have a whole lot of federal government to pay for.
Okay, so what you're saying is that there would be some kind of sales tax if products were being imported. But again, the question is, what if I don't want to pay the sales tax?
Well, the Constitution identifies two types of taxes, direct taxes and indirect taxes. Direct tax is basically one that you cannot avoid. It's sometimes called a capitation tax. This is the tax, and you can either mail it in or we'll come and get it. The other type of tax is an indirect tax, which is very much like a tax on gasoline. And your choice is, I don't want to pay the tax on gasoline. Okay, ride a bicycle.
Okay, so the capitation tax, how are you going to collect it?
The capitation tax? Again, there was the way the Constitution is supposed to work. Congress sets down and decides, we've got Project X, you know, whatever it is. And again, hypothetically, we've got good, honest politicians representing us, you know, and we really need something that the people would actually want. And Project X is going to cost $1 million. Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3 says that representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned to the several states. So that, okay, how do we know how many representatives in the House each state gets? Oh, my God, we're going to have to count everybody in the country? So California has 10% of the people, so they get, you know, 10% of the representation in Congress. And, you know, that would, we got 435 members, you know, 10% of that would be, you know, 43.5, and unfortunately they don't let me cut a representative in half, so California gets 44. Okay? What would prevent California from just, like, you know, buggering up the census numbers, and let's say they managed to double the number of people who actually live in California? What would prevent them from doing that? Well, the Founding Fathers understood checks and balances, and it says representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned. So when Congress, you know, approves Project X for $1 million, Washington, D.C. would then send a bill for $100,000 or 10% of that to Sacramento. And Sacramento decides how they're going to pay it. If they've got $100,000 in the treasury, they write a check, mail it to Washington, D.C., and the people of California, you know, like, don't know, don't care. You know, Sacramento could also send out a postcard, you know, to the, I think, 30 million people in California, and say, you know, write us a check for 25 cents, you know, mail it in with a 45-cent stamp, you know, and we'll
pay. I hear what you're saying. I think the question I'm asking is, once you decide what the tax is going to be, don't you need an enforcement arm to collect the tax? Whether you call it the IRS or you call it whatever,
right?
Don't you need an enforcement arm?
Well, yeah.
To force compliance.
But presumably, again, this is a completely hypothetical situation, we have representatives that are only collecting taxes for things that we want. So there's not going to be a real big problem with the enforcement. Most people are going to be voluntary sending it in. And yes, that would be a legitimate tax. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1 says that Congress has the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises for three reasons. It doesn't give, you know, like for every April 15th for any damn thing they want. So, you know, again, I mean, I have no problem with people say, well, I don't mind paying taxes. I just want to pay the lowest amount of tax that I can. I want to, like, you know, make it real cheap. And I say, well, I don't mind paying taxes either to a constitutionally justified government. But that's not what we've got. As soon as you get the government to start following the Constitution, I'll be, you know, a lot less upset about having to fill out a 1040 form. You know, again, whatever the project was for, I mean, it'd be probably pretty rare. I mean, in whatever the federal government is doing, they would be funding it using these excise taxes. So, you know, it's kind of a catch-22 question. You know, it's like, you know, God can do everything. Really? Can God make a rock so big that even he can't pick it up? It's like, I don't know. I mean, and I'm happy to sit down and discuss these things, but, you know, whenever you get into the, you know, position like this, people are always, you know, creating questions that are like, I don't know, it's hypothetical. I don't know what would happen to be there. But, you know, if it's a legitimate thing, the tax is going to be really low, and I think that most people would, you know, voluntarily pay it. And if, you know, you're one of those holdouts that doesn't want to, and it's like, don't arrest him, I'll pay it. You know, we've got a free market, a capitalist society. I'm making so much money, I got you covered. Don't sweat it.
Next. We have about 20 minutes left in our official schedule, so you know, we'll do that. We know we're scheduled to end at 5:30, but if our debaters would like to stick around, if you have the availability, I don't want to.
I view this as an extremely pleasurable, brilliant questions, great audience, so I'm happy to stay as long as people want to stay, so let's get the next question. Great fun.
Sure. Do you guys, you want to point out the questions from now on?
Yeah, you've had one. You. Commies aren't cool, dude. There has to be at least one guy at every libertarian meeting whose beard is longer than his hair. That is a fact of life, and it's good to see that you've filled that niche. Thank you.
My question is actually for Michael. I support you a lot. I got your book right here. Basically, every question, I have a couple questions, but basically everything that's been directed towards you, you've been no government. Shouldn't you be an anarchist then? I mean, everything you've been saying has been no government. And also, what exactly do you propose would be government, and how exactly would you pay for it? Like, Pat Buchanan says, oh, this country, tariff, not our own country, but aren't they individuals? Shouldn't they not be forced to pay things also? Isn't everyone's an individual, so just not our country? And also, our founding fathers, what gave them the right to write a document over me? Did I give them permission for that?
Which document? The Declaration?
The Constitution. I didn't give permission to anyone to write a document over me. Founding fathers or not?
Well, nobody gave the founding fathers permission to write the Declaration of Independence. They just did it. And I've already said that the Constitution, they didn't have the authority to write the Constitution. They were sent to Philadelphia to modify the Articles of Confederation. They closed the doors, and they basically shit-canned the Articles of Confederation, which I think would have been better in many cases. I mean, not as good in others. And they came out and said, you know, I mean, everybody knows that it's easier to get forgiveness than permission, you know, and I don't know exactly how it went, but it was probably, you know, Benjamin Franklin spilled his beer on the, you know, Articles of Confederation, the ink smeared, we couldn't read it, and, you know, so we just kind of wrote down and, you know, sat down and wrote this Constitution, and, you know, we know it's not what you asked us to do, but all you have to do is ratify the Constitution and all will be forgiven. You know, well, it wasn't by the numbers, but, you know, eventually all 13 states did ratify the Constitution. One of the things that my students in my class usually stunned to discover is that, you know, if you want to burn the Constitution, if you want to shred the Bill of Rights, I don't care. They go, but the Constitution says. I said, well, I don't care. Don't tell me what the Constitution says. You know, most of the time, they're telling me what some state statute says. You know, Michael, you're telling me you've got a right to keep and bear arms, but they've got these laws. They've got these 23,000 gun laws that say, I don't care. I don't care what it says. After Heller versus Washington, D.C., a Supreme Court decision, first Supreme Court decision about the Second Amendment in, I don't know how many years, I got like a dozen phone calls that morning. Oh, Michael, I want to be the first one to tell you about Heller. You know, the Supreme Court voted 5-4 in favor of Heller. So, well, we thought you would be excited. Why would I be excited? Well, because the Supreme Court identified the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms, as an individual right. So I didn't know that before. Do I need a Supreme Court vote of 5-4 to let me know that I have a right to life?
Exactly, but why do you need government to tell you anything then? Why not let that be up to you? And every example that's come up to you, you have non-government solution to it. So why not just be non-government?
Let me say this again. I would be happy with anarchy. You want to get all the government away and make it go away? I'm fine. I'm happy to mutually, but that's not going to happen, because most of you out there don't have the courage to pull the trigger and defend yourself. You won't kill somebody else who's trying to kill you. You want somebody to do the job for you. You don't want to take the time to learn all that science, to learn all that math, so that you can exercise your responsibility to teach your children. So you're going to go and, I mean, I'm not the one that's been sending my kids to government-controlled schools for over 50 years. Parents have the responsibility to teach their children all the skills and values that child needs to be a functioning adult. Parents will send their Johnny and Susie off to college, let the government and let the teachers do the reading, writing, arithmetic. Nowadays, I mean, in 1953, Americans were number one in math and science. We are now 29th in math and science. So even if the Department of Education was constitutional, and it's not, we should stop doing that, because we're going in the wrong direction. And so parents, the children are graduating from high school, they're functionally illiterate, they can't read the diploma that you just handed them, and mommy and daddy have the audacity to complain that, well, my child just hasn't learned the values I wanted them to learn. Why the hell not? Because you gave that responsibility away to the government. So don't blame me. I'm a skydiving instructor. Who do you think packs my parachute?
Yeah,
I do.
But it's also a thing of principle. Just because the war in the Middle East isn't going to go away, do I have to support it just because it's not going away? No, if it's government, I'm not going to support it regardless, and I'm going to speak on that. Just not because, oh, it's not going away, so I'm going to support why this should work. No. If the war in the Middle East isn't going away, I'm not going to find a way to support it. I'm still going to be against it, just like government. You can say it's not going to go away, but you can still speak out against it.
I am trying to eliminate as much government as possible. I don't know, you know, who else is, you know, running around talking about these things. I don't know, you know, we have people here, you know, disagreeing on whether or not anybody has any rights. I'm pretty clear that I do and will, you know, physically defend those rights. You know, most people, when I teach my class, you know, I ask, why do we have any government at all? Why not? Anarchy. Let's just get rid of all, and they all go into seizure. It's like, oh my God, we can't do that. Like, why not? Well, you know, and then they come up with all these reasons why they don't want it. Well, okay, if we have to have government, why did the founding fathers pick a constitutional republic? Why not socialism? Why not communism? And basically, again, the purpose of the government that they designed was to protect your life, your liberty, and property. Well, it's not doing that anymore. Well, it's not the Constitution's fault. You know, again, capitalism gets a bad name because we've got a really lousy economy. Well, we've got the really lousy economy because we're not using capitalism. You know, the Constitution is getting a bad rap. It's like, oh my God, look how terrible. We got all this, you know, this evil, corrupt government. Well, it's not the Constitution's fault. Not the Constitution's job to protect you. It's your job to protect the Constitution. You know, you only have the rights that you are willing to defend. And, you know, most people are not willing to take the responsibility. You know, we were talking about moral decisions before. Well, you can only make a moral decision if you're intelligent enough to know what is moral. And, you know, excuse me, but those of you that are watching Dancing with Stars and Jerry Springer and, you know, American Idol and Lost and all these other quote-unquote reality television programs, it's like, excuse me, you know, like, go to a museum, pick up a book. You know, I just cannot, I can't feel a whole lot of sympathy for people that, you know, I mean, I have people order copies of my book and copies of my DVD, and I look at this stuff in the order blank, and everything is in lowercase. You know, it's like, you never learned grammar? You never learned how to spell? You know, no wonder you can't read the Constitution. So we need to, you know, we need to remove the government. You know, there is no education system. It's an indoctrination system in this country, you know. And we've got, like, a whole lot of government to get rid of before we can talk about whether we can get rid of all of it.
Hi, this question is for Michael. This is obviously a debate on how much government is necessary, so I'm going to assume, even though I haven't read your book, that you're going to bring your most powerful point to bear today. Now, what I've heard is that, in contrary to Stefan's, that we need government because people are not willing to, are not comfortable defending themselves. I will postulate that everyone here is more than willing to defend their family violently with extreme force if they have to, right? Isn't that, no one here not defend their family, right? Also, I am quite happy with the fact that everyone here would be uncomfortable using a gun. That makes anyone here who raises their hand and is happy killing somebody or is comfortable, I don't want them by me. So I think that's amazing that most people are not comfortable doing that. Now, with regards to, and you, the other point was that we're not, that the mass majority of people are not intelligent enough, are not educated enough to to have an anarchistic society based on the free market, but you are traveling the country trying to educate these stupid people. Thing is, though, is that are you trying to raise an army, or are you trying to educate people to be happy? Do you want people to stand up against the government and die, or do you want them to be happy in the here and now?
I would love to have people happy. Most people aren't. You know, most people don't even know what they need or want in order to be happy. You know, having this free and open society is an ideal. And there are just people, I mean, I don't know how to answer the question without, like, alienating certain groups. I mean, if you go into the ghettos, I mean, there are people in the ghettos that they don't have very much. You know, they've lived four generations with this welfare state. They have come to belief, the sincere belief, that, you know, we owe them a living. The government is obligated to give them food and you know, education and all that stuff. Well, I mean, you can want my property all you want, but, you know, you're not going to get it, not if I can stop you. And, you know, I'm happy that people think that they would be willing to defend themselves. If somebody comes up and starts choking you, I don't think that anybody could just stand there and let it happen. People will claim that they are, like, nonviolent, but, you know, self-preservation is going to kick in, and when you start gasping for air, you're going to start at least squirming. You're going to make it difficult for somebody to hold on to you. You know, maybe start, you know, scratching their eyes and just doing something to make the other person go away. It may be very, very bold and make everybody feel good to say that, oh, sure, I would use deadly force to protect myself. Well, I was out at front sight gun training. I mean, these are the people who are, you know, like just all Rambo. You know, these are the people who I think are most likely to physically defend themselves. And I'm telling you, they won't. You know, when it's only a paper target, you know, they can be real macho and, yeah, you know, like, you know, I scored all these headshots. But, you know, it's really difficult to think that, you know, you'd have to take somebody's life. And I think that it would disturb you for a long time. Most people don't like the reality, the fact that in our society, that may be necessary. I think the NRA reports that there are 2.5 million times a year that somebody uses a gun to defend themselves or their children. Fortunately, 90% of the time, they do that without pulling the trigger. You know, just merely displaying the gun makes the bad guy go away. Well, and I'm not going to get into a great big long Second Amendment discussion, but, you know, if you think that you would defend yourself, oh, okay, I'm happy to let you think so, but it's not as easy as you might think.
Okay. My question.
I don't know. Sorry, I don't know where you all are living, but you might want to move. This is like, you know, choking and people with guns. The most aggression I ever face is politicians tell the media to type bad things about me. That's all I face. But sorry, you had a question to that?
Yeah, it seems like we just woke up in this socialistic nightmare, and we have 20 years before the only way out is going to be a collapse. And I was just curious what your comments are on that idea. I know Ludwig von Mises had actually mentioned it a lot at the very end of his book on the Book of Socialism. And I was just wondering, I heard some of Steph's podcasts where he makes the comment where, you know, just your chains will magically dissolve and everything will go forward. It's going to be dramatic, but blah, blah, blah.
Sorry, what did I say? You changed the...
Your chains will dissolve. You make this argument that philosophically, if you present these ideas to people, they will understand them and then we'll no longer be tax slaves. And it just doesn't seem like it's going to happen that way. It seems like in this socialist nightmare that we're a part of, the only way out of this thing is to let the system collapse and then move forward from there. And I guess what I'm asking is there anything you can do to prepare yourself? Rand made an argument that the best defense is to surround yourself with like minds. She also makes arguments that that's even more powerful than surrounding yourself with guns. I guess I'm just sort of opening up and asking, you know, suppose the scenario happens. The only way out of this collectivist socialist nightmare is a form of collapse. Let the system collapse. is there anything that you are doing for yourselves personally beyond what you're currently doing, trying to make people aware, to go through this stage of what's probably going to be very dramatic?
Yeah, I mean, the collapse is inevitable. I mean, anything which mathematically cannot continue will not continue. I mean, that's just a basic fact, right? There's no fuel in the plane. We don't know when it's going to hit the ground, but it's not going to stay up. So this is a very, very crucial and critical time, which is why, I mean, for my, you know, like I can't get that interested in another software release relative to, I think, trying to do some real good in the world in these kinds of topics. The collapse is going to happen, and it's too late. We hit the iceberg like two generations ago. The ship is going down. But I think that what we really want to do is to get people to understand why the collapse occurred, right? We want to get people to understand that the reason that the collapse is occurring is because of violence, because of institutionalized, organized, statist, predatory, violent, ugly, and evil coercion. Because people are constantly told that voluntarism is causing all our problems. It's the greed of the bankers, right? It's stupid. The bankers were as greedy 50 years ago as they are now. Why now? It's like blaming a plane crash on gravity. So I think it's really, really important to keep hammering on people, and I know this sounds like an ugly way of doing it, but keep repeating to people as positively and emphatically as possible that the problems in the world stem from violence, right? Stem from the initiation of force and fraud and so on. And that way, when things go wrong, and Ayn Rand is getting a remarkable, well, not that remarkable, resurgence in her popularity because Atlas Shrugged predicted all of this stuff with pretty eerie, not eerie, stunning accuracy, like 50-plus years ago. So I think you want to be right. You know, that's really, really important, obviously. And you want to make the reasonable predictions. You want to remind people that the world is going downhill rapidly because of increases in violence. And the violence occurs in many, many ways, the fiat currency, income tax, debt, all of, you know, we all know it, right? Keep telling people, there's a gun in the room, there's a gun in the room, there's a gun in the room. Society is run on blood. Society is run on violence. Statism is force. There is a gun in the room. Because if people can't see the gun in the room, then the people are just falling over. They don't know why. Oh, my God, it's a microbe. Oh, they fainted, right? But there's a gun in the room that's being pointed at the human race, at the human face. And if we keep pointing that out and we keep, because people already accept that violence doesn't solve problems because they don't go for a job interview and take the guy hostage to get the job. They already understand in their own lives that violence will not solve their problems. If we get them to understand that society runs on this kind of violence and they understand they can make that connection, well, it doesn't work in my life, it's not going to work in society as a whole. We get them to make that connection, then when things go bad, they'll stop looking for the bankers, and they'll stop looking for the capitalists, and they'll stop looking for the multinationals, and they'll start to look at where the violence really is, which is the initiation of force represented by the state. That's the first place they'll look. It's not the only problem in the world, of course, but when you look at societal collapse or societal problems, people have got to start seeing and drawing the conclusions between the violence that never works in their own lives and the violence that cannot work so socially. But until they see that violence and have it repeatedly, patiently, and positively pointed out to them, there will be a great mystery, and then bad people will say freedom has failed. But freedom never fails. Violence fails, and we keep reminding people of that. Then when the crash occurs, they'll know why, and we can start to build something better out of what comes after.
I agree that the economy is going to fail, the structure is going to collapse, and it will always be replaced by something. Well, I said a number of times that we are in an ideological war. And what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to win what we replace, you know, after the collapse. You know, I want people moving in the right direction. I want them moving in the direction of protecting private property. And they can't do that if they think that the government is the answer. You know, the government's not the answer. It's the problem. And so I'm doing my best to change the way that people think and to get them to, you know, acknowledge the individual rights of everybody and to take the personal responsibility that's going to require to make it happen.
All right, my question is for Michael. As a former presidential candidate, obviously you wanted the job. So let's just assume that you won.
No, let's not assume that I won it.
Well, if you did win, what services would you want the government to provide, ideally in your utopian society? Would it be none? Would it be just defense? Would it be roads? What's the baseline?
Article 1, Section 8.
You know, when people were talking to me, it's like, well, you know, what was, you know, assuming you get elected, what's the first thing that you would do? Well, eliminate the Federal Reserve, eliminate the IRS, you know, send executive orders to the IRS telling them to come to work and make a pot of coffee, start dusting off your resume because you guys are going to be out of there. Send a letter, executive order to the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, which really should be a convenience store and not a government agency, you know, and let them know that if they take a gun away from anybody that is not at that moment committing murder or robbing a bank, that I will personally, you know, see to it that they are prosecuted for violating somebody's individual rights. And I gave a... I did an actual book signing at a bookstore. It was kind of impressive, and I answered all these questions. And, you know, one lady says, well, you know, okay, so what are you going to do, like, after the second 2 weeks? And I said, well, play golf, I guess. And it's like, well, what do you mean? I said, well, my job is to keep the government really small, and after, you know, we get this list of things, there's really not going to be a whole lot for me to do, and, I don't know, probably go out and play golf, you know, do photo ops. You know, as President of the United States, I don't have the authority to go around and send troops to anywhere I want. So, and again, to address that first statement, no, I didn't want the job. The only question that I resented as a candidate was, well, you're not going to win, so who are you going to vote for? It's like, would you ask George Bush who he was going to vote for? You know, I'm not doing this because I want to be president. I'm doing this because I don't want the Democrats and Republicans to be president. I don't like their idea, you know, of that job. You know, I cannot vote for the Democrats and Republicans and respect myself in the morning. So if you don't like the way the other guy is doing the job, you just got to do it yourself. I've got time for about one more question. I think I have, I actually have to head back to Texas. And my ride is going to be leaving here very soon.
Okay. Does anyone have a question specifically for Mr. Bet? Okay, great.
So,
yeah.
You've made it very clear that you're a minarchist and you don't believe anarchy works realistically. So I guess my question is that, well, it goes throughout history, it seems that people have progressed and we've gotten less, like, totalitarian governments, like, we've had, like, kings and emperors and dictators, and it seems as we've considered life getting better, we've moved from absolute monarchies to constitutional to democracies and republics.
We don't have a constitutional democracy. You can't find the word democracy in the Declaration, Constitution, or the Bill of Rights. We are a republic, and there's a significant difference.
All right, but it appears, though, that as we've moved to a, like, people have more say in their government, life's gotten better. So what I'm saying is, maybe it's less government that's made life better, made it possible to advance. So why not just shed government entirely and just argue for that rather than just try and keep it minimal when it seems to be the problem?
Anarchy is just not possible because most people don't want it. People... My original metaphor was alcohol. You know, you can only distill alcohol so far, and you always get a little bit of water in it. You know, I think the standard of living goes down if you don't have any government at all. I think that they're, you know, it's a necessary evil. You know, the convention in Atlanta, I said that, you know, fire is a dangerous servant and a fearful master. We need fire to survive. You need it to warm the house. You need it to cook your food. But anytime the fire gets outside the fireplace, you know, it's a bad fire because it could burn the house down. And I suggested that the Founding Fathers understood that, you know, a little bit of government is necessary just to kind of, you know, keep everything, you know, organized rather than doing the mafia thing and let the mafia decide, you know, how to resolve the murder of your loved one. So, you know,
the founding fathers understood that a little bit of government was necessary, but it's got to be a place for it, and they wrote the Constitution. Any government that is within the Constitution is a good government. Any government that's outside the Constitution, you know, is a bad government and needs to be stomped out. So, again, I'm trying to whittle the government down to the size of the Constitution, specifically Article 1, Section 8. You know, once we get government, you know, actually controlled, and the Constitution, the piece of paper, is not going to do it. You know, I loved Stefan's metaphor. We, you know, like, hold up that piece of paper, you know, like, you know, it's only a piece of paper. You know, it's only a collection of ideas, and those ideas are only going to triumph if most of the people here share those ideas. But unfortunately, most people think that they can just vote for the candidate that's going to give them the most free benefits. You know, we operate as a republic or as a democracy instead of a republic. And, you know, people don't have the ideas. They're ready. The girl whose mother needed prescription drugs, you know, she was happy to have me become president and steal money from somebody else and, you know, give that money to her for her mom's drugs. You know, people live in contradictions all the time. You know, I'm trying to, you know, protect my own life, liberty, and property, and in the process of doing that, you know, I'm accidentally fighting for your life, liberty, and property, too. You know, it's kind of a fringe benefit. I can't help it.
Okay, can we get a round of applause, please, for Michael Badnarik?
I really want to thank everybody. I want to echo Stefan's comments. I love this kind of stuff. I just eat it up. I can sit here. I tell my students that I can answer questions about the Constitution longer than they can ask, and they almost beat me to it last Saturday. We stayed up until about 1:30 in the morning talking about the Constitution. My website is constitutionpreservation.org. My email address is there if you'd like to send me a question about the Constitution. That's kind of like one of my favorite things to do. Out of my 200 email a day, those are the ones I answer first. So, again, thank you for your interest in actually being willing, whether you agree with me or with Stefan, just being here to listen to the debate. Thank you for giving me hope for the future that anybody even cares.
We've got one or two more, if anybody, you can stay or leave, but we had one or two more questions that I will attempt, and then we'll start talking all about Michael.
He's still here. Go ahead. You can leave.
Sorry, and I'm sorry, I'll try and imitate him if I can.
Okay. Speaking of all of us being in this room caring today, actually caring about what happens with our lives, what are things that we can do to combat apathy and so many people that we encounter every day?
Well, what people most want, and it's an old argument, goes way back to Greek philosophy, what people really want is happiness. I mean, it's the one thing that we try to get for its own sake, right? Like, we got on a bus to go somewhere, we'll buy a car to drive something, but happiness we don't do for something else, we do it for itself. The most motivating thing in the world is joy, it's happiness, is enthusiasm, and that is infectious. Now, not everybody wants to be happy. Some people look at a happy person and they get all kind of, you know, like bad Ayn Rand characters, you know, like they just hate it or whatever, right? But for those people who really do like being happy and feel inspired at joy, I believe that the equation is something like this, right? Reason equals virtue equals happiness, right? You have to think and you have to have non-contradictory ideas. You have to have rational ideas. You have to put those into practice as best you can. I mean, nobody's perfect, but you have to do that. And what comes out the other end is happiness. And the best way to get people, I think, interested in philosophy is to live your values as rationally, as consistently, as joyfully as possible. And then people will see, damn, she's happy. Right? And if you're happy, people want to know, like, if you live in a world of really overweight people and you're relatively slender, some people will go, I hate those thin people, right? But some people will go, I like some of that. And they say, well, how did you get, like, if you want to sell people a diet, right? And so if you want to get people interested in reason and evidence and philosophy and thinking, you have to lift the values to the point where you've become really happy yourself, and then people will be interested in how you get there. And I think that's how, because, you know, people on the Fed, and we'll get rid of the Fed, and we'll, you know, get currency, and this stuff's very interesting. It's fascinating, right? But it's not what people get up in the morning really wanting to do, is to study the Fed or, you know, read a book by Thomas Woods or Ron Paul or whatever. Great though they are, and interesting though they are, what they want is to be happy, to be connected, to be in love, to be enthusiastic, to be joyful about their lives. The more you live your rational values, the happier you will become. And then for those people who want to be happy, who still have that spark of enthusiasm to want to go out and get that joy in life, they'll want to know how you did it. And you'll say, Steph told me. No. I've been thinking. I've been really thinking and reading and I live my values, and these are the values that I live, and I consistently apply them, and that results in happiness. And that's, I think, the best thing we can do is to be happy and enthusiastic, to show people empirically what the results of rational and happy values are, and then those who want to become happy will really want to do that. I know that's a real hippy-dippy answer in a way, but does that make any sense at all?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, actually.
And we can control that.
Your own advertisement.
Yeah. I can't control whether there's a Fed or not, but I can control whether I live my own values consistently. And if I'm not happy, I sort of look back and say, okay, well, what did I do? What part of my wife's commandments did I disobey that I've ended up not happy? Why am I cold? I didn't take a jacket when she told me to, right? But you want to be happy and enthused, not fake, you know. You know, like some of those dad Christian pictures of the family, it looks like, you know, but genuinely happy, and people will really become interested. And then if you talk about things like the Fed or the economy, Austrian stuff, this, that, and the other, people will say, well, she's happy, and that's good. So other things she say have credibility. But a lot of libertarians are like, they're like Gollum, you know, they're like, you know, evil. And so people are like, well, they might be right, but I don't want to be that, right? So I think you want to try and be a person that people have something of real value to offer called happiness, and they will then be interested in how you got there. And that's, I think, the best way to, I certainly am doing a lot better since I really began to live my values, which took entirely too long than before, where I was right, but only in a really abstract way. You want to really personify, I think, rational happiness, and then people will want to get there, because you can control that. You can't control the Fed, right? Oh, that makes me so happy. Now I'm more right. you haven't had your question yet. It was the other guy, right?
Hi, Steph. I had a question for you, I think.
I want to be happy, so I'm leaving.
I had a question, I think when someone asked you about the American experiment, you said that you know, it was a great stride philosophically for the founders to set up this republic or democracy or whatever. I know someone also mentioned Han Tappi. He also has another book called Democracy, the God That Failed. I don't know if you read it or not. Mm-hmm. He points out that most people regard democracy as a procession up the ladder of civilization, like a good thing, whereas he would argue that monarchy had many redeeming qualities over democracy, such as like in democracy, every war is total war. People say, you know, we're invading Iraq, or, you know, we're not. People that call themselves a state are invading Iraq. In monarchy, that was never the case, but actually people, like, would go up to the castle walls and watch the soldiers battling and have popcorn and back and things like that. And I was just wondering what you thought about this.
The idea that a monarchy is they own the country. Right, so democracy, nobody owns anything, and everybody can prey on everyone else. But in a monarchy, the aristocratic families, they actually own the peasants, they own the land, and so they have an investment in continuing that value, which in democracy that you just don't have. And the other point, which in case you didn't hear, is that in a democracy, the war is total war. Right, in the aristocracy, it was like what a couple of hundred inbred idiots whacking each other with swords while everybody sat around and watched, and wars were, you'd never have more than a couple of thousand people. But it was the democracies that started the 10 million plus genocide of the First World War, the 40 million plus of the Second World War. So, I mean, I think those are great arguments. The problem that I have with that, and I'm not claiming to be any expert on his argument, but the problem I have with that is that it certainly is true that war has become more total, but I would argue it's more a function of technology than democracy versus aristocracy. I mean, if you'd had bombs and planes and machine guns and this and that and the other in the 15th century, they would have just borrowed and done that and killed more people that way. I think the other problem that that argument has is that when the aristocracy did not, almost inevitably, did not raise the wealth of the average serf. I mean, you look from, you know, like the fall of Rome, sort of 400-500 AD till, you know, 1400 AD, right? You've got, that's all aristocracies, no democracies in Europe at all there, and living standards are, you know, a complete catastrophe that whole time period. When you do start to get some liberalization of the economy, which went to some degree hand in hand with democracy, what happened was you started to see a rise in living standards because serfs are affixed to the land like a tree, right? Whereas workers can move around and there's some competition for them. So living standards under a democracy generally tend to go up, and living standards under a monarchy tend to be flat, if not declining. So is it the additional wealth of democracy that makes it possible to wage more total war? Is it the technology that comes out of the free market that comes from a democracy? I think that's arguable, but I don't think, obviously, he's not saying that monarchy is the solution. He's saying that there is a kind of private ownership, but I don't think it translates to any benefits for those in the middle or the bottom, which in democracy it tends to, if that makes any sense.
I think that might just be a function of there happened not to be any free markets under anarchy. I'm not advocating anarchy, but monarchy, sorry. But if there were free markets under monarchy, I think Hobbes would argue that people would be better off because kings also have less incentive to tax because they don't want to have rebellion because it's very easy to just kill a king, you know, reinstate a new one. Right. I mean, if someone wanted to kill Obama, that wouldn't accomplish anything because then Biden would just move right up and doesn't, you know. But I also wanted to add that even if they did have, air jets and things like that and weapons of mass destruction, the kings had more of an incentive not to involve the populace because the populace did, according to Hoppe anyway, they viewed the king as more something they had to tolerate and not some, you know, the king had his own business, he took his own, took care of his own affairs and things like that, and they just kind of paid or do whatever. I mean, I'm not sure what you have to say about that.
One of the beautiful things about being an anarchist is you can't answer questions like how should things be funded, right? I mean, with all due respect to Michael, it was not a clear answer, right? Well, it is forced, but you don't actually have to pay them because I'll cover the guy who can't, right? So you don't end up in that kind of muddy stuff. The other thing you don't have to do as an anarchist is you don't have to say which of these lesser of two evils would you prefer, right? Democracy or monarchy, which is better? It's like, well, they both suck. They may suck in different ways to different degrees, but as an anarchist, you just have to say, I don't want to be shot in either kneecap. Thank you very much. And if you make me choose, I guess I'll choose one or the other based on whatever criteria I prefer. You know, do I want to live the life of a drudge, you know, like the Monty Python guy? You know, he must be a king. He hasn't got shit all over him, right? Do you want to live the life of that drudgy slave but have less of a chance of being killed in a war? Or do you want to maybe have a chance for a better life with an increased income with a greater chance of being killed in a global, in a world war? Those are like, I'd love to have a society where neither of those choices exist, and that really is the state of society, in my opinion. So I think they're interesting questions, but, you know, to me that's like, you know, which shit piles you want to wallow in. I say let's go forward where we don't have those and then not worry about which one was better or worse under which circumstances. But I think they're very interesting theoretical arguments for sure.
Yeah, hello, check, okay. Hi. My question has to do with, for lack of a better term, international relations and how an anarchist territory can't be the world initially. It has to be part of some landmass, and that there's going to be disagreeing peoples at some kind of a porous border that disagree, and they're going to, like, let's just say it was the territory of America, that there would be some point where people said, oh, I'd rather be part of the nation of Canada, or I'd rather be part of the nation of Mexico, for whatever reason.
Sorry, in this, which country is anarchist in this?
America.
America's anarchist.
I know you're Canadian.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I'll come there. I'll come here if that's the case, right?
Thanks.
Okay.
So my question is also in relation to that, how like the United Nations or other countries sometimes will say they don't legitimately recognize a nation, like if they have a new government and they say, oh, we don't recognize that nation, we aren't trading with them. What I was wondering is, obviously, there isn't a government, so if people were trying to trade internationally, they would be
trading with private companies or individuals, and that there wouldn't be any governments trading with, or would governments outside this territory trade with individuals?
Well, remember, governments don't trade with anyone, just to be precise, right?
Yeah.
It's companies that trade with other companies.
So with that dynamic and stuff, like, how would an anarchist country deal with, like, if governments pass laws that said private companies can't do business with an anarchist nation, or, like, all these kinds of questions?
That's a great question. There's an old economics argument, maybe you've heard it, maybe you haven't, which is to say America and Japan, right? It's the question of you always hear trade wars, tariff wars, right? So you're Japan and I'm America, and you say you can't import wheat. I can't export wheat to Japan. And then say, you can't export rice to America, right? And we get into this escalating war. It's completely ridiculous, right? And I'll give you an example. Let's say I, as America, come up with a cure for cancer, and you, as Japan, come up with a cure for AIDS, right? And you say, America, you can't sell your cure for cancer in Japan. And then would it be rational for me to say it's better for my population, who already have access to this cure for cancer, if I block you from selling your cure for AIDS to my population? Would not be advantageous, right? So the fact that one country is imposing trade barriers on another country in no way, shape, or form implies that that country should then retaliate for any. It just means that, unfortunately, the people who want to sell wheat to you are kind of hosed. They've got to sell it somewhere else or switch crops or something. And so if a foreign government says you can't export your stuff, no government is going to say reasonably that you can't. They're going to say to their own citizens, you can't sell to the anarchic country. How would they know, in a way, right? I mean, there's no border that we would take care of as an anarchic country. And so you would lose out to some degree not being able to trade into a status society, but you would still be way better off letting the status society trade with you and just trade internally for the things that you weren't allowed to export. It would still be vastly beneficial to the anarchic society. We're not reliant on the foreign governments to allow us to trade outside us. I mean, we still get the advantage of them trading with us, if that makes any sense.
Last question, maybe?
Or are we completely? Have we completely run dry? Oh, did you? Did the camera person have a question? Why is your forehead so shiny?
I just have a general question, I guess. In your definition, what is an anarchist?
A bad person, right?
Evil.
I get the reptile head, right? Well, an anarchist, obviously there's many, many different definitions of it. That's why I sort of said it's an anarcho-capitalist variety. Certainly, and I think the basic requirement of an anarchist is to not recognize the legitimacy of the state. And I think that most anarchists would not recognize the political or moral legitimacy of the state. Anarchists certainly do respect authority. Right, as Bakunin said, and somebody has this on my forum, he said, what does it mean to say I reject all authority when it comes to dealing with a shoemaker? I respect his authority with regard to the shoe. So it's not a rejection of authority. It is a rejection of the moral authority of organizational violence. Now, there's a lot of complicated nonsense about anarchy. Like, people say, well, we shouldn't have property, and, you know, we're an anarcho-socialist, and so on. I don't like any of that stuff, fundamentally, because it seems to me that if you want to be an anarcho-socialist, an anarcho-capitalist society is your best friend. Because you don't have to exercise property rights. It's optional, right? If someone steals my car, I don't even have to report it. I can just say, hey, it went to the collective good, and whoever needs it can use it, and fantastic. In a free society, if you want to set up some hippy-dippy, flesh-pit, bond-smoking, whatever house of infinite carnal knowledge, you can do all of that. You can all get together and have group hugs and spread whatever bacteria you want back and forth, but you can have that collective ownership. You cannot exercise property rights. You can collectively work the land. You can, you know, raise naked children, do whatever you want, right? And there's no way that a free society, I mean, maybe get involved with the protection of children, maybe, but is not going to say you have to exercise your property rights. An anarcho-socialist society, to me, could only exist if it specifically opposes the exercise of property rights. Now, what agency is going to oppose the exercise of property rights? It would have to be an agency that has some sort of compulsion, right? I.e., I want to keep this. No, you can't, because you're not allowed to keep anything. right? And so you simply have a big contradiction there, right? Because you have to have, you're supposed to have no authority, but in order to enforce nobody exercising property rights, you have to have some authority. So I think that whole system just doesn't work at all. I think one of the reasons why anarcho-socialists don't like anarcho-capitalism is that they know in a free society very few people are going to end up in their hippy-dippy, you know, commune farm nonsense, right? Because, you know, people are going to go like, man, I got to get something done with my life. I got to go do something and be in society and maybe gather together some capital, and air conditioning is nice, and I like my food irradiated perhaps, so I like fluoride, I like to be able to visit a dentist, like all those kinds of things, right? Like the second generation Amish, you know, it thins out a little bit. And I think they know that if they're in a free society and they have to, in a sense, compete with a private property society, that they're just not going to be able to sustain themselves. And that's why I think they want to create this, you know, the whole country is a hippie commune or whatever. And I'm being a little disrespectful to the views, but that's, I think, the major difference is you have to reject the institutional authority of violence. And after that, I would say you have to logically sustain property rights, but not everyone agrees. All right. We can do two more.
Okay.
Two more
questions coming all the way over.
Oh, we said two. You can't see behind you, can you? The guy in the back. No. Sorry. We're going to take this, ladies, and then just teasing you. Go. No. Don't. Okay. No. Don't. Sorry. Go ahead. No. Not you. Look, it's chaos. It's anarchy right now.
Just curious, in an anarchist society, how would you think to deal with child abuse? I mean, a child obviously can't go to an independent agency and say, my rights are being taken away from me by my parents.
Right. No, I think that that really is, and we always wait till the end for the essential questions, right? Because you cannot have a peaceful and free society where a significant proportion of children are mistreated. And unfortunately, a significant proportion of children are mistreated even in the current society, and we have one of the more enlightened societies with regards to the protection of children. So you simply can't have a free society if a lot of people are coming out hyper-aggressive, damaged, unable to concentrate, and so on from difficult households. I think that parents are going to want to have legal protections for their children's actions. I think that's going to be pretty basic, right? Because if your child goes and, throws a rock through someone's window, you're going to want to have some kind of protection. You're also going to need to have medical insurance or some kind of medical protection for your child. If you send your child to school, which most people will in a free society, because homeschooling is a desperate measure based on how bad the schools are, right? But in a free society, schools will be incredibly well-tuned towards the maximum capacity of teaching children. So if you want to go to school, you're going to need to have some sort of DRO protection for your child, immunizations, whatever it is it's going to be. So children won't make the contracts themselves, but children cannot escape the necessity, parents can't escape the necessity of having their children in some kind of social net of contracts and obligations. Now, DROs are going to want to minimize as much as possible how expensive it's going to be to insure children. Right, like everyone, right? Like if you're a non-smoker, you get better rates from the insurance company. And so DROs are going to say, look, if you want to save as much as humanly possible on your child's insurance, which you're going to need to have your children function in society, we've done all the research, we've compared all of the possible parenting methods, you know, you pay us $200 for a parenting class or $2,000 for a parenting class, and you will save, you know, $300 a month on your child's insurance, because we know that people who parent this, and this way, we've got the evidence, and it's empirical, and it's scientific, and it's proven that this is the best way to parent children so that they're peaceful, they're nonviolent, they're not, you know, poking other kids with sticks and so on, and they're less stressful, they're less likely to get sick and so on. And so you have an agency which is not the state, which has virtually no interest in protecting the rights of children, other than, of course, some dedicated individuals like the superheroes of the child service agencies. But with DROs who want to make it as cheap as humanly possible to ensure the health and safety of children, they're going to redo the research to figure out what kind of parenting best keeps children peaceful and best allows them to accelerate their education, gives them the best social skills, produces the fewest bullies, and so on. And so they will offer huge incentives for parents to get involved in the styles of parenting that are the most effective. And they may be different for different cultures and different for different types of children and so on. But there will be very, very strong efforts to minimize the cost the destructive past that children have in society, because, of course, children who go wrong, I mean, not only are very expensive when they're young, but, I mean, the social cost is huge. Now, at the moment, it's borne by taxpayers who can't do anything about it. But you can also say, as a DRO, you know, when your kid turns 18, if you followed this particular plan, we will also insure them at half price, right? And so it's a huge net savings. Is it going to be perfect? Of course not. There's going to be people living in the woods who beat their kids, and that's terrible. But, you know, we're trying to put a system in place where things can be as productive and positive as possible. And I think that's a real rough sketch. There's more about that in the book, but does that sort of make any sense about how I think it could be more proactively handled?
Yeah, but are you saying then that you would force people to get insurance for their children?
No. It's not forcing.
Okay.
Right? It's not forced, right? Like, so, for instance, I mean, I know that there's debate about immunizations, but we got Isabella immunized. And we want to send her to a private school because public schools suck, and I'm not going to try and reinvent educating children, at least. I mean, some people do, and I just don't think it's right for me. And they have said, you know, we want her immunization records in order to attend when she comes to attend the school. They're not forcing me to get her immunized, but if I want to send her there, then I have to get her immunized. And they have every right to request that, right? So nobody's forcing parents to do anything, right? But what they are saying is that if you want us to extend protection to your child for damage, for health care, for whatever, then you need to, then you can pay full price and you don't have to take any parenting courses, right? But if you want to save half price or 75%, then take these parenting courses and it will be a good investment for you. It's like, you know, you go for your driver's license. If you've taken particular courses, you can get reductions on your insurance. And if you haven't, you pay full price. So it's not forcing anyone. There's just balances of incentives, if that makes sense.
Who had the, I think it was...
There was a gentleman at the back, and then maybe we'll do. Okay. He seemed quite eager. That's a great question, though, by the way. It's very important.
I have one big question. I don't quite understand. How would you be able to maintain anarchy? Because I kind of really think that you'd always have your, you know, getting back to the Michael Corleone idea that there will be groups that will pop up and they will try to control other groups of people violently. And these groups can spread. They can get funding from other countries. They could take on, you know, they could be self-sufficient, have their own corporations, and just expand and be a government, that, you know, that minimalistic government that, you know, Michael was talking about.
Were you here? Because this question came up once before. Was it that my answer sucked for you or you weren't here? I mean, either one is fine. I'm just wondering which one it was.
I may have missed it, but I may have not understood, you know, your answer. There was a question about, you know, what constitutes a government, and I didn't quite get a clear answer to that. But I totally can see how a group of people can come in and start a gang. Just like the government's a gang itself, they would start their own gang and try to control people. You know, right now we have gangs because of, you know, drugs are illegal. But if drugs weren't illegal, there would be no gangs. But there would still also be the trafficking of people in one way or the other, making them work as serfs, if you will. How do you prevent, you know, this from happening? You're talking about these organizations, these insurance companies, if you will, kind of making you work in society in a particular way that's constructive to everybody. But I also think that at some point, if I do something bad and I get turned away from all these insurance companies, there's always going to be another insurance company that says, oh, you know, I don't care what you did in the past. You know, come on in. You know, you can order food here.
Sure. Now, let me just take that last scenario. I did answer the first one earlier. You can look at the book. And again, you may not agree with everything I'm saying. I'm sure you won't, right, because you're a thinking person, and I'm certainly not going to say I've got everything right. But let me just deal with that last point, and then if you're not satisfied with what's in Practical Anarchy, just give me a shout or, you know, come by the Sunday show and we'll talk more. So the issue, and it's a great, great point that you raised, the issue is some guy gets kicked out of a DRO because he's a total jerk or something, right? He's just a nasty guy, doesn't keep his contract. And so there's going to be some other lower tier, you know, trailer park PRO who's going to come squidge in and say, it doesn't matter what you've done, right? I mean, I'll insure you, no problem. And there will be that aspect of things for sure, but remember, DROs are only valuable to the degree with which other DROs will work with them. Right, so I can print my own currency, nobody cares, right, because no store will accept it. Right, I could come up with a credit card that one model railroad store in Nunavut accepts, and nobody's going to, because it's only useful in one store, you might as well use cash, right? So it's the interoperability or the cooperation of the DROs that makes them valuable. And so if I have some low-rent DRO that sidles up to criminals and says, I'll represent you, no other DRO is going to want to do business with me. Why? Because there's no point having the punishment called ostracism if you then cooperate with the DROs who pick up the ostracized people. Then it's not punishment at all. And I would not be able to sell that to my customers saying, don't worry, I'll ostracize people who don't fulfill their contracts and then not do it. People would just stop using me as a DRO and I would go out of business. So I have to have some standards of behavior and interoperability, and all DROs would have the same incentive. And so if you have some DRO that will pick up criminals or whatever and try and insure them, the problem is no other DROs will deal with them, and so they're kind of useless. And they would just have to be enormously expensive because no other DRO, so they'd have to duplicate everything that all the other DROs were doing. So I don't see how that could practically work, just because you have to have that interoperability for DROs to work. I have to be able to take my DRO money from Philadelphia and go to Scranton or to Columbus or whatever and use it there too. If those DROs don't recognize that DRO, it's not really worth anything to me, right? So there has to be this interoperability for them to be of value at all. And those criminals who are ostracized, the DROs who pick them up will themselves be ostracized and therefore won't have any value to the people that they're representing. Does that make any sense? It is a good answer. Whew. One! Yay! I hit my personal best today. One good answer. Beautiful. I should stop now. Oh, wait, you had one more. You want to? Here, I'll just give you the mic.
Thank you. First, I'd like to say your patience for our questions, or sometimes not questions, is awesome. So as an anarchist trying to live my principles, sometimes I find it overwhelmed. I feel overwhelmed by the fact I'm living in a world that's so embedded with statism in our economic and social realms. And here, just college grad, trying to move out of the house and having trouble getting a job. The only job I could get was for a company that has lots of government contracts. And I mean, I'm trying to switch to an environment that's better suited for me, et cetera, et cetera. But sometimes I feel a little guilty about this company that I work for. What advice do you offer for how you draw the line, or for what you find acceptable or what you resist? Thank you.
Let's get the easy question at the end. That's great. Young anarchist. Oh, you're so rude. Wait till you can get a podcast and then come out as an anarchist. No, I'm kidding. No, that's a great question. So the question, when you graduated from school, look, I took government contracts when I was an entrepreneur, and I was already a staunch objectivist and minarchist and this and that. So you did not create the world that you live in, right? Obviously, if you'd had the choice, you would not have had the statist predations infesting and infecting the society that you live in. You have to make your way in the world as it is, right? We can't live in the future. We can't crawl into the books of an anarchic blueprint and live there, fun though it would be to try, right? So you have inherited a world from people who unfortunately just have not done the work necessary to clarify and work to eliminate the violence that is inherent in the society that we live in. That's not your fault, obviously, right? It's not your fault that you have inherited the society where you can't be a purist, right? I mean, people come to me and they say, oh, you're against the government, you have a podcast. You know, TCPIP was the Department of Defense of the 60s. And right? Like, yeah, okay, so what? I'm supposed to just, like, not breathe air because, the government defined the standards for air conditioning or something? I'm not going to be that kind of purist, because that is to take on the sins of the whole world and say, I'm completely responsible for them, and I can't breathe, and I can't live, and I can't eat food because farmers get government subsidies, and I can't drive on the road because the government has produced the roads and the buses are subsidized. Like, you couldn't do anything in life. And that, to me, that can't be right. You know, like, I'm not sure exactly all the reasonings why, But just standing there not consuming oxygen until you die can't be the only way to live morally in society. That kind of self-destruct. And what kind of world would that leave to people if we don't have enough to eat and we don't have a way of getting access to the internet, of buying books, of learning, of reaching out to other people, of washing, right? You know, I'm an anarchist. You know, I haven't bathed in 4 months because the government supplies the water. It's like, ugh, you could be right, but I don't want to find out, right? No, you got to shave. You got to, you know, whatever, right? I mean, you've got to live in the society that you find yourself in. If we're born doctors and it's a time of plague, we just do what we can. I mean, yeah, we risk, we take risks and so on. I would say very much this is what I found with my professional life. I made lots of mistakes this way, and hopefully a few of my scars will give you some useful tips. I would not bring political voluntary anarchism into my conversations about government contracts at work. I mean, it's just, you can do it, right? But, it's going to be really, really tough. And I think that's not productive. Like, I think you need to eat, you need to educate yourself, you need to live a happy life within the confines of the society that you live in. I think that you need to dedicate yourself not to the sort of fruitless opposition of abstract things that you can't control, but really on focusing on living as many of your values as possible within your own sphere of influence, right? Within your own personal relationships. Professional relationships, you're not paid to be an anarchist at work, right? You're paid to be... All right, so you do help desk at work. Fantastic. So they're paying you for help desk. Anarchy, not translated to help desk, right? So it's not like...
Now that I've solved your software problem, let me tell you about the society you live in. There's a gun in the room, quick, right?
So... They're paying. That was my first podcast. I never published it. But they're paying you for your help desk, right? So you provide the help desk service, and they're not paying you for anarchism. If you can find a job proselytizing about anarchism, fantastic. Go to town, right? It's a hard road, but it's well worth it if you can work towards that. But be professional in your job and do that which you're paid for, right? I mean, if my doctor is against the healthcare system, I still want them to write me a prescription, right? I don't want them to lecture me about the healthcare system and send me out with my infection intact, right? I want them to do their job, and their job is not to talk to me about anarchism, and neither is your job at work. Some of your paycheck is going to come from government, but there's no way to escape that unless you want to go live on nuts and berries in the woods, in which case we abandon the world to the bad people, right? If all the good people say, well, I have to be so pure that I can't function in society, we just leave the future of the children in the world to the worst people in the world who don't give a crap about integrity and virtue, right? So we fight the tough, ambiguous fight. There's a certain amount of what you can live with that no one can tell you, right? I mean, there may be some government contract that comes up where you're just like, oh man, I can't do it. And no one can tell you whether or when that occurs. And I don't think there's any objective line. I really don't. Okay, maybe frontline soldier in Iraq. I don't know, right? But you just have to be sensitive to how you're processing stuff, right? There's only a certain amount of stuff we can watch before we just go, you know, we can't do it anymore, right? But I would certainly not create some abstract rule that says I can't do any job where there's government money ever involved, because then you can't have any job at all, right? If you're a waiter, some guy might be an IRS agent. You don't know. You then become paranoid, right? So I would say it's more of a gut sense and a gut feel. But I think that the thing is, as I was saying to the lady before, who didn't leave but napped, is that right? No, I'm just kidding. Sorry, it just looks like you. But as I was saying before, don't let the evils of the world and the institutionalized violence of society bring down your spirit, right? Because it is in the indomitable will and joy of our spirit that we are going to lead human beings to a higher place. You know, if we're going to be those kinds of lighthouse leaders, like helping people in from the far seas of statism, we have to have that kind of joyful, happy integrity. Don't let the evils that have accumulated throughout history that you're not at all responsible for crack and break down your joyful spirit and your pursuit of a better world and an elevated species, right? That stuff doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that bad people made shitty decisions in the past, right? That doesn't cling to us. That doesn't cling to our souls. We stand as tall and as firm and as proud as we can without taking responsibility for the sins of the past, right? Statism is Catholicism, right? You just have to reject. There's no original sin that way. right? We struggle to do the very best that we can for the sake of joy, not for the sake of changing the world, because you can't change the world without joy. You aim at changing the world, you get frustrated and miserable and don't change anything except your own level of happiness for the worse, right? So I would stand tall with the joy and integrity of the truth and the virtue that you have. Don't let the slings and crap of statism that you didn't invent and aren't responsible for stick to you. Be sensitive to what you can take emotionally and be aware of where it just becomes too unpleasant and, you know, work to figure that out within yourself and change what you need to be. But the whole purpose of evil is to make good people feel guilty for breathing, right? And I just don't think we have to feel that way at all. We have an incredible gift to bring to the world, the gift of truth and of reason and of evidence and of virtue and of happiness and of peace, right? And we have the key that unlocks a really golden and beautiful future. And if we feel stained by the sins of the past to the point where we become ashamed of being the most reasonable and, I believe, the most virtuous people around, we're just surrendering to the darkness a light that we just don't have to. So I hope that gives you some sense of at least how I approach it, and that was a great, great question.
All right, thank you very much, Stefan, for coming out here to Philadelphia. Greatly appreciated.
Thank you.
Just another reminder, thank you everyone for coming, and also just please, if you can donate, I really ask that you would. I appreciate it, and thanks for coming.